May I welcome you to the first lecture in the spring series of the Vancouver Institute, and let any of you who are still standing the doorways and would like a seat know that there are seats in the other lecture rooms. I would also, of course, like to urge those of you who are not already members of the Institute to become members, and you can do that at a table out in the hallway after the lecture. I think that we have a very interesting program in the spring series, and it is obvious that the first lecture is of great interest. I had considered a fairly elaborate introduction to Sir Alfred Eyre, but I don't think that he needs it. He is Wickham Professor of Logic at the University of Oxford and a fellow of New College in Oxford. He is the author of a large number of works in the field of philosophy. I had wondered if there would be great interest in what has become of philosophy. It is clear that there is, and I think no one is better qualified to speak to you on that subject than Sir Alfred Eyre.
Well, good heavens. What a horrible thing. Can I try without?
No. You won't be audible in the other rooms without.
Oh, God. Well, you've been brought here under false pretenses to some extent, because the title isn't my title. And it's only one kind of philosophy I'm going to talk about, that's analytical philosophy. So my subject much narrower in scope than you might have been led to suppose. A good thing, too, because the other one would be impossible to deal with in an hour. And secondly, since coming to your delightful climate, I've caught bronchitis, so that my voice is liable to give out. With those two warnings, I start. And I start with a quotation. Oh, incidentally, please don't think me ungrateful if I talk about the climate. I'm very pleased to be here. I start with a quotation. Damn this thing. Must I?
Would you like to try just with this one?
Oh, yes. Can I have all these wires taken away? I know it's meant to be a building full of resources, but you've overdone it. Now then, I start with a quotation. Philosophy must be of some use, and we must take it seriously. It must clear our thoughts and so our actions. Or else it's a disposition that we have to check and an inquiry to see that this is so. I.e., the chief proposition of philosophy is that philosophy is nonsense. And again, we must then take seriously that it is nonsense and not pretend, as Wittgenstein does, that it's important nonsense. In philosophy, we take the propositions that we make in science and in everyday life and try to exhibit them in a logical system with primitive terms and definitions, etc. Essentially, philosophy is a system of definitions, or only too often, a system of descriptions of how definitions might be given. This quotation comes from a book called The Foundations of Mathematics, a collection of papers by F.P. Ramsey, a Cambridge philosopher who died in 1930 at the early age of 26. The paper in which it occurs was written in 1929. It represents a view of philosophy which was then coming into fashion, at any rate in England, and to a lesser extent in the United States. The allusion to Wittgenstein relates to the Tractatus Logico-Philosophicus, the only philosophical work, apart from one short article, that Wittgenstein published in his lifetime. One of the main purposes of this work was to set a limit to what can significantly be said. And this limit was so narrow as to deny sense not only to most of what has so far passed for philosophy, but to the propositions of the Tractatus itself. They were compared to a ladder which one could throw away once one had climbed up on it. The mere fact, however, that Wittgenstein thought it profitable and indeed essential to make use of the ladder showed that his allowing its steps to be nonsensical was disingenuous. He wanted his assertions to be believed, but to believe an assertion is to take it to be true, and what lacks sense can be neither true nor false. As Ramsay put it in another context, what you can't say, you can't say, and you can't whistle it either. The idea that there are inexpressible truths which can, as it were, be whistled, gives currency to mysticism as well as to metaphysics, but it is nonetheless untenable. By 1929, Wittgenstein himself was beginning to repudiate most of the Tractatus, or much of the Tractatus, but he retained the view of philosophy as a disposition which we have to check and an inquiry to see that this is so. He held that philosophers were led to raise spurious problems through their misunderstandings of the ways in which language worked. And by various means, which were designed to remove those misunderstandings, he sought to put an end to philosophical perplexity. Am I audible at the back of the hall? Thanks very much. His aim, as he expressed it, in a much quoted phrase from his posthumously published Philosophical Investigations, was to show the fly the way out of the fly bottle. Philosophy, on this view, consists in the first instance in getting oneself imprisoned in the fly bottle, a meritorious, if misguided, act, then in beating one's wings against its sides, and finally in discovering and pointing out to others the method of escape. This conception of philosophy has had its devotees, still has. But to many of us, including those like myself, who had found great enlightenment in the Tractatus, it offered less than we wanted. Though it was pleasant to fasten the charge of uttering nonsense onto other would-be philosophers, the idea that philosophy consisted only in the commission and redemption of sins against the canons of language appeared to devalue the subject more than it deserved. For the most part, therefore, in the 1930s, we opted for the second of Ramsay's alternatives. The purpose of philosophizing was to clarify, not just through the exposure of metaphysical nonsense, but through defining in the cardinal terms of ordinary and scientific discourse and exhibiting their logical connections. It might have been thought that to represent philosophy as no more than a system of definitions was also to devalue it unduly. But that wasn't how it seemed to us then. We admitted that a great deal of what has been called philosophy would have to be sacrificed. In a rather insensitive fashion, we offered it the consolation prize of being reclassified as poetry. But we thought that enough remained to justify our claim to the goodwill of the former establishment. There was, after all, a Socratic tradition, the tradition of raising such questions as, what is justice? What is truth? What is knowledge? of which we could claim to be the heirs, and an empiricist tradition to which we could also lay claim once we had purified it of its accretions of psychology. Hadn't Locke declared himself content to be employed as an under-labourer in clearing the ground a little and removing some of the rubbish that lies in the way of knowledge? This was indeed a piece of mock modesty, overemphasizing the merely negative aspect of Locke's achievement. But the image of clearing the ground was happily chosen, and it wholly suited our book. We were wrong, not indeed in claiming this inheritance, but in our estimation of the legacy. Though they may sound like requests for definitions, the Socratic questions are not really such, at least in any straightforward sense. They are not questions to which one looks for the answer in a dictionary. And even if they had been, our conception of philosophy would still have been unduly narrow, as I shall later try to show. But first, I want to explain how we came to adopt it. The main reason lay, I think, in the grant of autonomy which we thought ourselves obliged to accord to all other domains of knowledge. And here, in England at least, an influence even greater than Wittgenstein's was that of another Cambridge philosopher, G.E. Moore, who, after entrancing Bloomsbury with his Principia Ethica at the beginning of the century, had proceeded by the 1920s to become the champion of common sense. Moore's contention was that he knew for certain that what he called the common sense view of the world was true. This didn't commit him to accepting everything that the man in the street might happen to believe, but only to the truth of such general common sense assumptions as that the world contains an enormous number of physical objects which preserve their identities through longer or shorter periods of time, independently of their being perceived or thought about. That some of these physical objects are sentient, and that among those that are sentient, a considerable number are the loci of what Moore called acts of consciousness. He also claimed to know for certain the truth of a great number of particular propositions from which the more general propositions followed. Such propositions as that he had two hands, that the earth had existed for many years before he was born, that at such and such a moment of time he was seated in such and such a room which contained such and such items of furniture and such other human beings, that at various times he was having, or had already had, such and such thoughts and perceptions and feelings, that other human beings had thoughts and perceptions and feelings corresponding to his own. He claimed also to know that he was not alone in knowing these things. There were examples of the sort of propositions that, in the appropriate circumstances, every sane person knew to be true. Moore didn't give any argument to sustain these claims to knowledge. As in his celebrated lecture to the British Academy, in which he proved the existence of the external world simply by holding up his two hands and saying, "Here's a human hand and here's another," from which of course it follows that there are at least two physical objects, from which it follows that there is an external world, he was content just to reaffirm that he did know what he said he knew. It is, however, obvious that he wasn't making these claims in the void. He expected his audience to accept the proposition that those hands existed because they could see them, and if they were doubting Thomas's, touch them too. He was sure that other human beings besides himself were conscious because of the ways in which he could observe them speaking and acting. He was sure of the existence of many past events because he could remember them, or because he accepted the claims of others to remember them, or because he accepted theories which entitled him to treat various objects as reliable records of the more distant past. But now we can see there is an assumption underlying all these claims, and that is the assumption that the reasons we have for holding these common sense beliefs are sufficient reasons. In the present circumstances, the evidence of my senses, interpreted in the light of theories which have been vindicated by the whole course of my experience, puts it beyond doubt that this is a sheet of paper, that those are chairs, and that there are people seated on them. My memory supplies me with conclusive answers to such questions as who I am, what I was doing yesterday, how I came to this place. Admittedly, there is room for error even in the case of such modest propositions as these. Our memories do sometimes play us false, even with respect to recent events. There are such things as hallucinations. Under the most normal conditions, our judgments of perception may be careless. Yet, when such errors do occur, they are easily corrected. I discover that my memory or my senses have deceived me because the beliefs to which they have led me are not corroborated by my subsequent perceptions, including those that furnish me with the testimony of other people. At this common sense level, our experiences are self-governing. They offer no foothold for philosophy to intervene. I have been elaborating on the assumption that the reasons which we have for holding our common sense beliefs are sufficient reasons. It may now be asked how this assumption can be justified. This is not a question which the champions of common sense have been very ready to debate. But I suppose their best answer would lie in an appeal to meaning. They could argue that sentences like, "This is a piece, is a sheet of paper," are used in such a way that the occurrence, under conditions such as these, of such experiences as I am now having, establishes beyond reasonable doubt the truth of the propositions which they express. And similarly, what a bad cold you have, worse than mine. And similarly with the other examples. To understand the meaning of these various sentences is to have criteria for deciding whether what they state is true. And whether these criteria are satisfied in any given instance is a matter for ordinary observation, not for philosophical argument. But now it is obvious that this position can be generalized. If the propositions of common sense are self-governing, in the way I have explained, so are the propositions which belong to the former or the natural sciences. So are those that belong to literary scholarship, to the study of history or of law. Of course, these disciplines are not kept in entirely separate compartments. Logic and mathematics may occur in all of them. History and literary scholarship make use of scientific results. The point is that in each domain, there are adequate criteria for deciding the truth or falsehood of the propositions which especially belong to that domain. And whether the criteria are satisfied is always a question of formal or empirical fact. I am not saying that this line of argument was explicitly developed by all those who acted on its consequences, only that it now seems to me to have underlain a conclusion which increasingly gained acceptance from the 1930s onwards. There were indeed limits to our grants of autonomy. Perhaps inconsistently, we drew the line at morals, aesthetics, and politics. Partly our reason was that there was not enough general agreement on these topics to support the assumption that they too were supplied with adequate criteria. Partly that with metaphysics and theology in the offing, We didn't want to run any risks of legitimizing appeals to intuition. So we didn't go all the way along the road, which ends in admitting everything on its own terms. But the extent to which we stopped short did no service to philosophy considered as a branch of knowledge. For in drawing the line at judgments of value, we also took the view that they were not cognitive. So far as the truth or falsehood went, of the common sense, scientific, formal, or scholarly propositions, which we did allow to be cognitive, we consistently denied the philosopher any jurisdiction. Not only did this put the skeptic out of court, for if we had sufficient reasons for accepting the propositions he professed to doubt, he couldn't possibly win. There might be some sport in seeing how he lost. But it left the philosopher with nothing to justify and no occasion even to speculate. For what could he speculate about? All the legitimate subjects were already preempted. In what way, then, except as a censor of nonsense, could he take part in the advancement of knowledge? The answer, which we have seen to be given, is he could tell us what was meant by various terms or by various types of statement. He couldn't criticize, but he could clarify. And in clarifying, he could promote criticism. Thus, Ramsay allowed that in special cases, an investigation of meaning might lead to a change in the meaning of some crucial terms. But didn't we already know what we meant? To take two of Moore's examples, was there any problem about the meaning of such statements as, this is an inkstand, or hens lay eggs? On the contrary, doesn't his defense of common sense imply that there can be no such problem? If we didn't know the meaning of such statements, how could we know that they were true? And in the cases where there might be a problem for most people, those of technical terms in the sciences or in other fields, the obvious conclusion of the argument which we have been developing is that the relevant specialist is the man to ask. Surely it would be a lawyer's rather than a philosopher's business to say what was meant by baratry, a physicist's business rather than a philosopher's to construe statements about mesons or neutrinos. The official answer to this objection was that, of course, there was a sense in which we already did know what we meant by the terms or the sentences on which we were setting the philosophers to work. After all, he wasn't supposed to be privileged in its respect. And if he didn't know what they meant in some sense, he couldn't get started. But there was also a sense in which we didn't know what they meant. Neither was this for the reason the terms in question were obscure or technical. They could just as easily be terms in ordinary use. I know what time is, said St. Augustine, so long as you don't ask me. But what was he hesitating about when they did ask him? If we continue to follow Ramsay, we should say that he was wondering how to define time. And in this case, our answer would be correct so far as it went, but it wouldn't go quite far enough. The reason why it wouldn't is that any definition that one might give would itself be likely to contain terms which called for further explanation, or at any rate, raised further problems. For instance, we might think of defining time as the locus of anything which is past, present, or future, or alternatively, as the domain of the relation of being earlier than. The question would then arise whether these definitions are equivalent, and if not, which of them is to be preferred. If we opt for the earlier than relation, we can define the past as anything which is earlier than some event E, where E is the speaker's current utterance or any other arbitrarily chosen event which is contemporary with the speaker's utterance. The present is anything which is contemporary with E, i.e. neither earlier than nor later than E, though commensurable with it, the future as anything which is later than E. This would, however, expose us to Bergson's charge of spatializing time, since the proposition that one event is earlier than another, assuming it to be true, is true for all time. There is no change in the temporal order of events. We are, as it were, taking a God's eye view of the whole series. But then what has become of the moving finger, the ever-rolling stream? It survives only in the fact that our own states, and consequently the different standpoints from which we actually survey the series, themselves occupy successive positions in it. Alternatively, if we take the notions of being past, present, and future as primitive, we can define the earlier than relation in terms of one event's being past and another is present. But then our account of time will always contain a subjective element. Since it will not only be describing the temporal series from a point of view within it, but relating all our descriptions to this point of view. The moving now can be indicated only demonstratively in some actual context in which the speaker finds himself. Neither is this the only problem about time. If we conceive of motion as continuous and want to escape from Zeno's paradoxes, we have to treat the moments of time as forming a compact series on a par with the points in space. If Achilles had to pass through an infinity of points one after the other, not only could he not catch the tortoise, but he couldn't get started. Before he had run a yard, he would have to have run half a yard. And before he had run half a yard, he'd had to run a quarter of a yard. And before that, an eighth of a yard. And so ad infinitum. Or in meters, if you prefer it. The difficulty is met by denying that there is any first point which he occupies, and any first instant after the start of the run at which he could occupy it. However short a distance he has gone, and however short a time it has taken him, he has been at some point nearer the start at some earlier moment. If this idea doesn't appeal to us, perhaps on the ground that it is hard to give it any physical meaning, we can try the alternative of conceiving of time as discontinuous. It will then follow that motion too is discontinuous. A moving object will be at place P1 at a moment T1, and at a different place, P2, at the next moment, T2, without there being any time during which it traveled from one point to the other. I do not dismiss this possibility altogether. One can never dismiss anything in physics altogether. But I do find it even harder to accept. Well, I mean, some things have got dismissed in the past, but which possibly won't come back, one or two things. Phlogiston. And in any case, what is a moment of time? The concept of absolute time has gone out of fashion, was anyhow difficult to make sense of. Certainly all we can observe is one concrete event succeeding another. We speak of measuring time. This is always a matter of matching two processes. The duration of a lecture, for example, against the movements of a clock. To take such and such a quantity of time is to take as much time as something else. It looks, therefore, as if the relational view of time imposes itself independently of modern physical theory. But in that case, we have to find a way of defining moments in terms of events. Using a device of Whitehead's, which was also adopted by Russell, we can identify the moment or instant of time with a suitably chosen set of events, each of which includes in its duration a shorter set of events. The same treatment as Whitehead has shown can be accorded to points in space, which can be equated with enclosure sets of volumes. I said a moment ago that the relational view of time imposed itself independently of modern scientific theory. In saying this, I did not mean to imply that the philosopher could safely turn his back on science when dealing with such concepts as those of space and time. On the contrary, if his treatment of these concepts is to be at all adequate, he is bound to take their scientific employment into account. Einstein's theory of relativity was in part a philosophical theory. One might say that he made clear to us what was meant by simultaneity, but I think a better way of putting it would be to say that he showed the current concept of simultaneity to be defective and substituted a more adequate concept for it. I have touched on this difficult set of problems in order to show that the philosopher's concern with meaning is not a simple matter of lexicography. In this instance, definitions are bound up with theories, and it's the power of the theory to explain the workings of the concept at every level that is the principal point at issue. I return now to Moore's examples, where the idea that we are looking for definitions seems harder to accept. For while we may all feel some perplexity if we are asked to define time, there is surely no difficulty about defining a word like inkstand, or the constituents of such a sentence as hens lay eggs. The dictionary does it quite adequately. We're not ignorant of the meaning of these words in the way in which a Frenchman might be ignorant of the English for un encrier. But in what way, then, are we ignorant of their meaning? The stock answer is we do not know how to analyze the sentences in which they occur. We know what is meant by the English sentence, this is an inkstand. We don't know how to analyze it. But what is the difference between knowing what a sentence means and knowing how to analyze it? The distinction is due to Moore, but he never properly explains it. In some cases, indeed, there would seem to be no difference. Thus, an example which occurs in the work of Moore and others is the proposition that brothers are male siblings, which one could easily find out from a dictionary, not from a French dictionary, because there is no word, French word for sibling, as I discovered the other day to my embarrassment. But from an English dictionary, yes, and a German one. It's not, however, a very good example, since the question what brothers are is not of any philosophical interest. What is of philosophical interest is the question how to interpret statements of identity and how it comes about that they are not trivial. If brothers are male siblings, why should the statement that brothers are male siblings tell us anything more than the triviality that brothers are brothers? You may say that it tells us something about the meaning of English words, and this is right in a way, but we have a mistake to think the statement was just about English words, as becomes clear when one translates it into a foreign language. One of our previous and much more interesting example that points to classes of volumes. If this is true, it is surely not trivial, and it doesn't look like a linguistic statement. At any rate, one wouldn't expect to learn it from a dictionary. The dictionary will also fail us when it comes to the analysis of sentences like this is an inkstand. And not only for the reason that in an example of this sort, the inkstand is not appearing in its own right, but merely as a specimen of a familiar, or familiar in the days when Moore wrote, sort of physical object. For looking up the dictionary definition of a physical object wouldn't profit us either. The question which Moore was raising when he asked the analysis of such sentences was, in general terms, the question how physical objects are related to the sense data which he thought the demonstratives were used to designate. But now we see that there can be an appreciable difference between knowing the meaning of a sentence and knowing its analysis. For it is hard to see how any mere reflection on the meaning of sentences, like this is an inkstand, could lead one to formulate Moore's question. To begin with, how do sense data get into the picture? The answer is that here again, we come upon the influence of a theory. Sense datum was the term used by Moore and Russell to refer to what was immediately given in sense experience. Up to that time, the time of their writing, early part of this century, there had been fairly general agreement among philosophers that our perception of physical objects was not direct. A perceptual judgment, like the judgment that this is a table, was thought to be an inference for which the awareness of some sensory item supplied the premise. These items were designated as simple ideas of sense by Locke, as sensible qualities by Berkeley, as impressions by Hume, as representations for Schnellingen by Kant, and as sensations by John Stuart Mill. More recently, a similar use has been made of the terms sensum, sense content, and sense quale, or simply quale. The choice of these different terms reflects different views about the status of the entities they were supposed to stand for, whether they were mental or physical or neutral, whether they were private, whether they were particulars or universals. The prevalent view, which is mainly due to Ryle and Austin, is that none of these problems arises, since there are no such entities as those that the terms in question were meant to designate. My own opinion is that while it is not necessary to have recourse to sense data, or qualia as I now prefer to call them, in order to describe the facts, their introduction is legitimate and in some ways advantageous. I do not, however, intend to argue this case here. The point that I wish to make is that whether they were good or bad, the reasons for bringing in sense data have had to do with meaning only insofar as the theory of meaning is connected with the theory of knowledge. To go back to Moore, his position was that while he frequently knew the truth of such a proposition as that this is a table, he not only didn't know what he then knew, in the sense he didn't know how the proposition was to be analyzed, but he also didn't know how he knew it. And the answer to the first question was supposed to provide the answer to the second. What was going to count as a satisfactory analysis of sentences expressing perceptual judgments was a way of reformulating them which would show how such judgments could be known to be true. Thus, sense data came into Moore's analysis because of his assumption that it is only through being presented with some sense datum that one gets to know that such and such a physical object exists. And if we ask why he thought this, and why so many philosophers have made similar assumptions, the answer is they have been persuaded by a set of arguments not about the meaning of words like see and touch, but about the possibility of illusions, the variations of the way things appear under different conditions, the causal dependence of our perceptions on the states of our nervous systems. These arguments bear on the meaning of sentences like this is an inkstand only insofar as they supply us with a motive for redescribing the situations which we take as warranting our acceptance of such sentences. If, as I believe, it is possible to meet the objections that have been raised against the use of a term like sense datum, its introduction can be defended on the ground that it helps to bring out the complexity of these situations, which, but for those arguments, we might have overlooked. Ever since Bishop Berkeley made his famous pronouncement that esse est percipi, to be is to be perceived, the introduction of sense data, or whatever fulfilled roughly the same function, has fostered what is called reductive analysis. An analysis is said to be reductive when it represents one type of entity as constructible out of another type of entity, which is taken to be more primitive. An example of such an analysis is Russell's and Frege's elimination of numbers in favor of classes. the new mathematics, I believe this has now become. Another would be the demonstration that political states, nothing over and above the citizens who belong to them. In the field of perception, the reductive theory is that which is known as phenomenalism, the theory that physical objects are constructions out of actual and possible sense data. It is summarized in John Stuart Mill's dictum that things are permanent possibilities of sensation. The advantage of a phenomenalist, as opposed, say, to a causal theory of perception, is that if it works, we do not have any problem about how we know that there are physical objects. Or rather, we have only the general inductive problem of explaining how we can ever be justified in going beyond our data. We don't have any further problem because we are making what I call a horizontal inference, extrapolating to entities of the same kind as those with which we started. On the other hand, if we regard ourselves as making a vertical inference, extrapolating to entities of a different kind, then we do have the further problem of supplying some proof that there are such external entities as our causal theory postulates. Objects which, according to the theory, we do not and could not ever perceive. But can it be doubtful whether there are physical objects? Mustn't an analysis of perceptual statements which allows this doubt be wrong? Not necessarily. The point which the champions of common sense have overlooked is there may be different sets of posits, as Professor Quine has called them, which might serve to account for our experience. And it depends upon contingent features of our experience that any such system works. It is a philosophical problem to make it intelligible how a system works. And the main objection to the causal theory of perception, at least in its classical form, is that it fails to do this. The difficulty is to see how we could possibly pick out any external objects as being the causes of our sense data, unless these objects could be independently identified. So long as the identification of these objects is made to depend exclusively on physical theories, it remains a mystery how the theories themselves can ever get going. This argument is not, however, an objection to the inclusion of a causal clause in an analysis which allows for the objects to be independently identified. From this point of view, phenomenalism is superior. But the trouble with classical phenomenalism is that it was too ambitious. It assumed that analysis had to consist in furnishing translations, or at least descriptions of how translations might run. And this seems not to be feasible. One has to fall back, I believe, on showing how the common sense conception of the physical world can be viewed as a theory with respect to a neutral basis of sensory elements. This is achieved by a method of fictive construction. One shows how the elements will get transformed into enduring objects and how the spatial and temporal relations found between them could be developed into a system. If this method is successful, it does in a way yield both an analysis and a justification. It shows how the theory works and that it works. In this case, a process of description seems to be enough. The positing of physical objects is not very hazardous, though it could conceivably go wrong. For example, in microscopic physics, the ordinary criteria of identity through time break down, and one could imagine this happening on a larger scale. It might be the case that objects move discontinuously, or that many fewer things stayed put over any length of time, so that we were deprived of our traditional frames of reference. I think that I can imagine an everyday world in which the concepts of field theory would be more serviceable than the particle concepts with which we actually operate. But even then, we could be philosophically content with description, a description of those features of our experience that favored the concepts of field theory. We should just be describing a rather different world. There are, however, more troublesome cases where description doesn't seem to be enough. One of the worst of them is the problem of one's knowledge of other minds. Here we have no particular difficulty in describing the criteria that we actually use. How do you know that he's depressed? He told me so. Look at him. He doesn't play with the children as he used to. He tried to kill himself. There is no question but that these are acceptable answers, at least in the sense that we unhesitatingly accept them when we're not philosophizing. We can be wrong, of course. He wasn't depressed at all. He had fallen into a Byronic phase. This comes out when the psychiatrist gets on to him. But then it does come out. More often than not, our attributions of mental states to others are settled beyond serious doubt. Why then should there be any philosophical doubt? The reason is not so much that things sometimes go wrong as that our procedures seem logically unsatisfactory. It's not that the accepted criteria don't work, but we can't account for their working in the way they do. The stages of the argument are well known. Some of the relation is not observable. Of course, it is observable in one's own case, and it is this that gives the theory that the connection is inductive, what plausibility it has. But it's an uneasy position to hold. The empirical evidence doesn't seem strong enough for the weight which is put upon it. This being so, why should the skeptic not prevail? Why do I not admit that I do not have any very good reason to attribute thoughts and feelings to anyone other than myself? I cannot, in fact, rid myself of the belief that other people do have a mental life, but I might be brought to admit that it was irrational. This seems to have been the position which Hume took with regard to most of what he called our natural beliefs, though he was surprisingly unconcerned with this particular problem. But it's not at all easy to hold a belief as firmly as I hold this one. I really don't think you're robots, and also think it irrational. So it's very tempting to fall back on saying that the evidence is sui generis, but nonetheless adequate for that. The trouble is, the skeptic's argument remains unmet. In one way, indeed, the skeptic has prevailed. His victory is shown in the prevalence of physicalism, which is the modern version of materialism. I cannot believe that the theory that sentences ascribing mental attributes to oneself or to others are equivalent to sentences ascribing physical attributes would ever have resulted from a dispassionate study of the way in which these sentences are used. If Carnap, and more hesitantly Ryle, made this suggestion, it was rather because they had become convinced that only by reducing the mental to the physical could they account for our ability to know about the mental states of others. The wildly implausible reduction of one's own mental states to physical ones was then forced on them by their acceptance of the valid argument that the analysis of statements about a person's experiences couldn't be radically different according as the statement was uttered by another person or by the person himself. I think the same is true of the thesis that mental and physical states are factually identical, though here a metaphysical preference for materialism is also at work. In any event, the assumption of factual identity does not get rid of the problem. For here it is conceded that what is in fact a state of the patient's brain is perceived by him as a feeling of pain. So the belief that he does so perceive it has still to be justified. And it surely cannot be deduced from our observations of his brain, even if he were equipped to make them. Consequently, even if we could be said to be witnessing his feeling when we examined his brain, it remains unclear how we could know that this was so. This difficulty would indeed be removed if we took the bold step, which some physicalists do recommend, of simply defining a mental state as whatever causes such and such behavior, and then applying Occam's razor. This does seem an improper begging of the question. The invocation of Occam's razor, though surely unjustified in this instance, if only because of one's consciousness of one's own experiences, does, however, create a difficulty for the otherwise attractive suggestion that we're justified in attributing mental states to others because this makes better sense of the evidence than any other hypothesis. Perhaps the answer is that we do not, in fact, have the physiological theories which would enable us to explain such things as intelligent behavior without attributing conscious purposes to the agent. And that even if we did have them, we couldn't make very much use of them. For instance, it would hardly be practicable to keep people's brains under constant observation. Even so, the theoretical difficulty remains, even if we did possess these theories and could use them, it doesn't seem likely that we should cease to attribute mental states to others any more than we should cease to attribute them to ourselves. We've come a considerable distance from the conception of philosophy as a system of definitions, though perhaps not quite so far from the Wittgensteinian idea of it as an attempt to rid ourselves of intellectual cramps. In the case of the problems which we have just been discussing, the Wittgensteinian approach gains some support from the fact that in dealing with them, we don't expect to come upon some new piece of evidence, some fresh clue to the existence of physical objects or other minds which had so far been overlooked. This does not, however, justify Wittgenstein in saying that philosophy leaves everything as it was. Neither does it commit us inescapably to the assumptions of common sense. Even when we do not expect any new evidence to be forthcoming, it is still possible to offer a radically new interpretation of the evidence which we already have. And indeed, this is just what Ryle and Wittgenstein were doing when they campaigned, rightly or wrongly, in fact, in my view, wrongly, against inner processes. At the present time, philosophical fashion, at least in the English-speaking world, has moved away from the theory of knowledge and concentrated more on topics within the field of what one might call logical grammar. For this, the influence of American philosophers like Quine, Davidson, and Kripke has been primarily responsible, together with the revival of interest in the work of Gottlob Frege, the great 19th century German logician, who, though almost unrecognized in his lifetime, is now seen in retrospect as having contributed more to the development of logic than anyone since Aristotle. Attention is paid to such questions as whether it is possible to give a systematic account of the meaning of sentences in terms of their truth conditions, whether there is an ultimate logical distinction between subject and predicate, whether proper names have a sense, as Frege thought they did, only as Mill thought a denotation, whether statements of identity are necessarily or only contingently true, whether Leibniz's laws, expressions which refer to the same things, can be substituted for one another without change of truth value, can be made to apply to indirect discourse. The treatment of these questions comes closer to being scientific. Hypotheses are advanced and are tested by linguistic examples. Logical grammar, like the science of linguistics, to which it is in some ways allied, is considered to be worth pursuing for its own sake. But it can also be seen as having a bearing on ontology, the theory of what there is. My own picture of the world is very like Hume's. I think of it as consisting in observable states of affairs, dispersed in space and time, with no necessary connections between them. There is no room in the picture for anything that is a merely possible object. We can deal with possibilities in a secondary, explanatory system. But to borrow an image from William James, the notes which are issued in the secondary system have to be cashed in primary coin. I am therefore interested in the development of a semantics which will reconcile the statements that I wish to hold true with this overall position. Thus, I adhere to Quine's program of eliminating singular terms because it consorts with the fact, or what I take to be the fact, that we are presented not primarily with particulars, but with qualities or patterns out of which particulars can be constructed. In many ways, Quine follows Russell, and there's an echo here of Russell's idea of making language reflect the structure of the world. If I'm asked how I justify my conception of what there is, I have to invoke my theory of knowledge. I go further than Hume in that I allow a thoroughgoing systematization of what I take to be the primitive data. But the outcome is closer to the data than anything else I can think of, which would be sufficiently elaborate to count as a world picture. At the same time, I do not want to rule out other options. In particular, I do not want to exclude the possibility of opting for scientific realism. But if one did take this course, I think the theory which one would then regard as providing a description of the world would still have to be justified by what I am taking to be the primary facts, even though these facts would themselves be explained in terms of it. One might object that this is not a question of options, but of what is actually true or false. It's not up to us to decide what exists. This is indeed true so long as we are operating within a system. We can follow Frege and Russell in treating existence as a property of concepts. This doesn't mean that only concepts exist, but rather that to say that something exists is a way of saying that some concept is satisfied. And whether or not a given concept is satisfied is indeed a matter of fact. But while this criterion of existence is acceptable so far as it goes, it ceases to be of service when we try to compare different systems. For then the question at issue is not whether such and such concepts are satisfied, but what concepts are admissible. And for this we need some other criterion. Russell himself implicitly acknowledged this when he talked about the ultimate furniture of the world. In terms of his own analysis of existence, his assertion that classes do not exist should have meant that no concepts ranged over classes were ever satisfied. But of course, this is not what he intended it to mean. He didn't wish to say, for example, that the whole of arithmetic was false. What he did mean was that classes are not part of the ultimate furniture of the world. But how are we to decide whether or not a type of entity exists in this special sense? Though he seemed to regard it as a matter of fact, Russell did not supply any criteria, and it is hard to see what criterion he could have given, other than that of the possibility of reducing the entity in question to some selected basis. It is because of its seeming that the basis has to be selected that I have represented the problem as one of a choice of pictures. This is in line with Carnap's view of ontological questions as relating to a decision to use one another form of language, and also with Quine's doctrine of ontological relativity, according to which the question of what there is makes sense only under cover of some theory. The drawback to any proposition of this kind is it opens the floodgates. Quine is a scientific realist, but he speaks of physical objects as posits, and he has said that from the point of view of the theory of knowledge, they are in no better standing than the Homeric gods. But surely we don't want to legitimize the Homeric gods, or at least we don't want to legitimize all gods anyway. Yet what can the relativist find to say against them except that they are excluded by his background theory? He can argue that a theory which admits them is less effective than his own in the sense that it makes a poorer job of systematizing our experiences. It could, however, be argued that we are already making use of a theory in deciding which is the better systematization. There is a touch of circularity here which may be unavoidable, but this seems to me preferable to complete permissiveness. I have touched rather lightly on a wide range of topics. There are many that I have left untouched. For instance, I have said nothing at all about moral philosophy. But I hope that I have been able to give you some idea of the course that the analytical movement has been taking. In particular, I hope to have shown that for all the sound and fury of its campaign against metaphysics has not turned its back upon the perennial problems of philosophy. It may even have contributed more to their solution than could have been achieved by a less prosaic approach. Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, although we have a large audience, Professor Ayer has agreed, as is the custom of the Institute, to answer questions. So if there are questions from the audience.
You said you didn't want to touch moral philosophy.
I said I hadn't touched it.
Well, what's your answer? Oxford students wanted a more ethical business.
Sorry. Didn't hear. What would I answer to what?
Oxford students who wanted more ethics in philosophy they were studying.
What would I answer to them?
Yes.
I'd say go and see Professor Hare. The question was, the gentleman thought quite correctly that I preferred the earlier Russell to the earlier Wittgenstein to the later, and whether I would comment on Russell's view. And I think, to some extent, Russell thought that Wittgenstein went to seed once he stopped hobnobbing with Russell. And I think he was right. Sorry.
Professor, it seems to me that I recall Austin saying that philosophers concentrate too much on, furniture and tables, chairs.
He said medium-sized dry goods.
See, the thing of the concern is what is the ultimate furniture of the world?
That's quotation from Russell, yes. No, because Russell thought that whatever Russell thought the ultimate furniture of the world was, it certainly wasn't medium-sized dry goods. It was probably something in the order of sense data at one Russellian period, and something in the order of four-dimensional point instances of another. So, I mean, it was Russell's use of the word furniture was quite different from Austin's. It's a very, very silly book of Austin's, that anyway.
Well, what I meant was, is not using the expression the ultimate furniture of the world,
yes,
leading oneself into very misleading associations.
Oh, no. You must have some historical sense. This term was used by Russell in 1912. And a perfectly sensible way, it just meant the ultimate entities which the world was furnished. Supplied, I mean, they could be liquid as well as solid or anything. And Austin's point about philosophers tending to take tables and chairs for their examples was made in some unpublished lectures delivered in the course of the 1950s. And so it's absurd to criticize Russell for not foreseeing that Austin would be very foolish 40 years later.
are not other questions, I'd like to ask Professor...
Well, we Brandon. Haven't started yet. Come on.
All right.
Let's have a sensible question.
I would like to know from you, Graham.
I fancy.
I would like to know from you what you assume an audience that you're speaking to know of philosophy. I have something I'd like to tell you about the lecture, but first I'd like to know an answer to that question from you.
I don't think I assume they know anything. But I assume that they... Wait a bit. I would assume that no one would come to hear a lecture like this unless they'd read a little philosophy, perhaps. Or had at least heard some philosophical talk on the third program, or vaguely familiar with the kind of noisy philosophers make. But I would not assume that they had necessarily done much research in it. Why?
Well, because I found your lecture often very hard to understand. Just the language used, words that you choose, that I'm not a philosopher, I've not studied philosophy. I don't immediately understand.
Yes, I think you might quite easily be right.
And I have my book filled with millions of questions of what you mean by this and what you mean by that.
Philosophy, like any other discipline, has its technical terms. And you wouldn't really come to a lecture in chemistry and having no knowledge of maths whatsoever and no idea what the molecule meant or atomic weight, what do you mean by that, and so on. It's awfully difficult to write about a subject which is, to talk about a subject which is technical without using, to some extent, technical language. I do try to use as little as possible. Now, people do have the ludicrous idea that, and to some extent, fostered by people like Austin, that all you need to understand philosophy is an ordinary use of enough knowledge of English to be able to read the Times. This is just false. It is a technical subject. I have tried to make it intelligible. I mean, to people of reasonable intelligence. But I think it's quite likely that I have used terms that needed more expression than I gave them, in which case all I can do is apologize and say that the same would have happened had I been a physiologist, a physicist, a chemist, or anybody else who is engaged in a technical subject. Perhaps even a historian. But this terrible idea, people say, they ought to understand philosophy. They think that, and you may have come thinking, I could tell you about the meaning of life and so on. But at least you were spared that. Yes? I think next to nothing.
Could you repeat? I think many people will not have heard the question.
The question was how far you can get with a dictionary alone, and I said next to nowhere, in the sense that any interesting piece of philosophical analysis will turn out, in my view, to involve some theory, and will really turn out to be a question in the theory of knowledge or whatnot, and merely knowing the conventional meaning of English words gets you nowhere. I do think that the whole movement that came to be, I'm sorry to say, known as the Oxford movement of philosophy, but it only lasted for less than a decade and did take place at Oxford, but then so did Bookmanism. I mean, at least that was only in the vacations, admittedly. It was a blind alley. I do think that the study of ordinary usage is of possibly some interest in itself, but solves no philosophical problems whatsoever. Unless it leads you into semantics, which is a serious subject, then it is a serious technical subject. I think semantics is a scientific subject. and does involve comparative linguistics and probably is pretty closely tied up with physiology and psychology when properly done. But I think, and I myself, I think, I made the same mistake in the past of assuming that philosopher was trying to clarify meaning in the sense in which we never were. And if you take Austin's own work, I think much his best thing is The Lasting of All, How to Do Things with Words, where he is actually starting on linguistic theory, where he's stopped worrying about what English words mean and worrying about the exact difference between inadvertently and by mistake and on purpose or whatever and so on, that sort of stuff, but is actually proposing a model that he could have argued with Chomsky about had he lived. That, I think, was valuable. Same with Wittgenstein. I think that Wittgenstein, though he says all he's doing is avoiding theory, is full of theory, and only interesting to the extent that he's full of theory. Most of the theories are negative, but I mean, nevertheless, a true negative theory can teach you quite a lot. And I think I'm partly to blame for this myself, that the concern of philosophy with what a dictionary can teach you is minimal. I can't think of a single decent example, really. I was thinking possibly in philosophy of law, but even then not. Yes? Gentleman with a bad digestion. Yes?
What would you say
I think it's been very disappointing, and this is a great historical misfortune that the philosophy and science got divorced at the beginning of the 19th century. I think science began to get too difficult and too specialised, so that you don't even if you meet a physicist, you have to say what kind of physicist are you? Are you a low temperature physicist or what? And so, the idea of the philosophers embracing all science. I mean, Leibniz might, and in fact, pretty well Kant even knew all the science of his day. From the 19th century on, this got more and more difficult. You've got this terrible romantic movement, this awful villain Hegel, the attempt of philosophers to say, we've got a better line of goods in the same market. I, sitting back in my armchair, speculating, can tell you what the world is like without even going anywhere near it or making a single experiment. This awful development, which really made philosophy in the 19th century, apart from two great philosophers, both who neglected in their time, Frege and Peirce, a disaster, then made a division which it now takes a long time to heal. And I myself think that philosophy hasn't any great future apart from science. And as a mere matter of practical academic politics, have got schools of philosophy and mathematics and philosophy and physics going in Oxford. Now, the School of Philosophy and Mathematics flourishes enormously. The School of Philosophy and Physics doesn't, because the physicists won't play. Because the physicists now think, for some reason, the philosophers are such asses, they won't let their best people near them. And it's very hard to get this thing going on those terms. All we get is the men they think not good enough to do physics. But we keep trying. But I'm perfectly certain that the best philosophers, if we can somehow get them in the next 50 years, are people who are going to come from within the sciences, and if not from within physics, then possibly from within biology, because I think physics had the first half of this century, and biology is going to get the next half. These are the great, and physiology, particularly physiology. Now, I think it's absurd people to go on about the mind in the way people like me do. I'm part of a dying race. I'm one of the people who had a classical education, and nothing is the purpose. I think one shouldn't talk about the mind unless one knows a lot of physiology, and I hope that people who will talk about the mind, it's one philosophical subject, will be people trained in physiology. I mean, I would like to see the philosophers coming out of science from, and if you're doing that here, then I applaud you very much. But then again, of course, it's going to be technical. Don't expect to listen to an argument on physiology and complain if you don't understand a word or two. Yes. He's a megalomaniac, but very clever.
Excuse me, the audience wouldn't have heard.
Well, perhaps as well they didn't. I think that Logik der Forschung is an extremely brilliant book. Peirce had the ideas before him, but it wasn't plagiarism because nobody knew. I mean, Peirce had the ideas for everybody. But certainly at the time that Popper wrote Logik der Forschung in 34, he didn't know anything about Peirce. It's only later that they discovered that Peirce had thought it first. I think that Popper slightly overplays his hand. It seems to me that he rather treats the whole of science as though it was modelled on a Michelson-Morley experiment. And that if you count botany as science, for example, then Popperian methods don't work. And actually, even in the Logik der Forschung itself, he abandoned his own criterion. Because if you remember rightly, his criterion is that he attacks the Viennese positivist for saying it's a question of meaning rather than of what's scientific or not. So he substitutes scientific content. And his criterion for proposition having scientific content is formally incompatible with the basic proposition, remember? Or with some conjunction of the basic proposition. The basic propositions are defined as propositions assigning observable properties to finite regions of space-time. Now he lets probability statements into the scientific fold and interprets them in an open frequency fashion, which doesn't allow them to be falsifiable, because notoriously an open frequency statement can't be falsified, because even if you get a million heads, it can always be compensated for by a million tails if the series is open. Therefore, and then he says, we're going to count something as falsified when it reaches more than an arbitrary statistical improbability. But this is to abandon his formal criterion. So even in Logik der Forschung, he cheats. But it's still a very, very clever book. And lately he's gone mad, but who knows? As one gets older, and it can happen to any of us.
I think we might have three more questions.
Yes. I ain't going mad, I'm going to smoke. Go on, yes?
What you believe would exist in the world without the existence of human consciousness?
Question?
The question is, what would exist in the world without the existence of human consciousness?
Well, I suppose very much what did exist before human beings came on the scene and what will exist when they've disappeared. In other words, I mean, this is in a certain sense a cheating answer, and I know it to be. But the theory I erect on the basis of my percepts, and then allow to govern ontology is a realistic one. And therefore, within the theory which determines what there is, human beings play a fairly subordinate position. The fact subordinate position they do play in actual history.
How closely do you still follow your verifiability criteria of meaning?
Well, how closely do I still follow my verifiability criterion of meaning? It was a good deal of a muddle, the verifiability criterion of meaning as originally stated in Language, Truth and Logic, because I never clearly distinguished, as it were verifiable by an ideal observer, as it might be, or by an observer suitably spaced, suitably situated in space and time, from verifiability by me. And I did a lot of the analysis in terms of verifiability by me, and they were all wrong, those ones. The ones I did in a narrow personalist view. I still hold some general criterion of testability, as to say, I think that any proposition advanced has to be... even that's not quite right, because I'm rather influenced by Quine's holism, I'm inclined not to require every individual proposition to be independently testable, but any theory, I think, makes sense only if there's some way of determining in the end by observation whether it's true or false. But this, of course, is very much weaker than what I started out with 40 years ago. I mean, the old grey mare, she ain't what she used to be. I'm afraid. But it was jolly useful while it lasted, the principle of verifiability. And a certain kind of nonsense won't come back. And even though it never got properly formulated, it's a lot of the uses which I put it is were questionable, nevertheless, it did do a good cleansing job. But that, of course, isn't as good as it being true. Yes?
The main task in analytical philosophy seems to be to close the door on metaphysics. Would you say that...
Oh, I wouldn't any longer say that. In fact...
I was just going to ask that.
Sorry?
Would you say that the findings of nuclear physicists have opened the door to metaphysics again?
I'm now one of the consequences of accepting something like a holistic view of language is that the line between science and metaphysics gets much more blurred. But I wouldn't have thought that accepting... what was your example? Microscopic physics? What? Nuclear physics? No, I mean, I wouldn't have thought that. I mean, I would have thought that always passed the test from the very beginning, in fact. And, I mean, one of the points about the Copenhagen people is what positivists they were. People like Niels Bohr. I mean, if the strong Copenhagen view that it simply makes no sense to talk of a particle simultaneously having a definite position, a definite momentum, not merely that it has one, but we can't find out, is a very strong application of the verification principle. So that nuclear physics is, as it was an ally from the start.
Ladies and gentlemen, I think that we...
And in fact, yes. And there was some historical counterplay there, inasmuch as Einstein was a disciple of Ernst Mach.
Regrettably, I think we should bring the question period to a close and not impose...
It's getting broader. Okay, you are stopping me from smoking if you stop it now, quite true.
So, I'd like to ask Professor Remnant if he would thank Professor Ayer on our behalf.
Oh.
Professor Ayer's permission. I hope the audience will excuse me if I don't attempt to plow my way down the front of the hall. May I say what a great pleasure it is to listen to a distinguished elder philosopher.
You say elderly.
I'm careful not to say elderly.
What did you say?
Senior.
Older. Well, everybody's older than someone. That's all right.
We'll get back on to time if we're not careful.
I'm thinking of the term in the sense of an elder of the church.
Okay.
A distinguished elder philosopher who has not come to tell us that the subject is now dead. The size of the audience and the enthusiasm of the questions would have refuted him in that case, in any room. In fact, during the past week, Professor Ayer has, on a number of occasions, been demonstrating philosophy alive and kicking. And he has done this in a series of meetings, of which this is the last, in which he has taken his audience skillfully, most of his audience, I should say, up to the cutting edge of the discipline at which he is still working, and has shown them what is taking place there. This is something that he is all the more qualified to do, in spite of his distressing miseducation, by the fact that he still wields one of the sharpest scalpels in the profession. May I, on your behalf, commiserate with Professor Ayer on his British Columbia cold, and thank him most sincerely for his very entertaining, very instructive address.
Thank you very much.